Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness and an evolution of our psychology and who we are as people and what is our destiny and what does the future look like for us. So I have tonight on my show Sam Menahan. He is a former president of the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. He's in private practice. He's a professor. He's a teacher. He's an interesting guy. And this is part of the ongoing series I am doing about ASP, the organization, the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. So, Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
So, as a former member of this organization that combines spirituality and psychotherapy, how did you come upon that? How did you come upon the idea of that we are spiritual beings, not just psychological beings? And then let's also talk about your book, The Great Cosmic Lesson Plan. So first, tell me a little bit about your introduction to that path.
Sure. Originally, I was a very flexible, open-minded psychologist when I was back in graduate school in the 70s. I got my master's at Columbia, and I was a pretty straight, combination of psychodynamic and cognitive therapy. Couldn't decide which was right, and I was very flexible. I had the good luck to not make the waiting list at NYU. I wanted to stay in New York, and of course, part of my great cosmic lesson plan was to go to California in the 70s. So I went to a wonderful place called United States International University in San Diego, and it sounded very interesting to me. They had a lot of spiritual people as well as psychological people, and including the wonderful Dr. Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's
really?
Search
Viktor
for Meaning.
Frankl. Oh,
yeah, he was on the faculty, as was Rollo May.
Oh,
as
nice.
Was Max Lerner, who was a famous columnist at the time. And we had to take 8 core courses in psychotherapy and related subjects before we even let us study psychology. So it was a wonderful place and a wonderful time to be there. I mean, it was very, very hippie, new age. And, there were, marathon groups and hot tub therapy. But it also, we learned a lot of psychology. And I was really starting to get to be introduced to the spirituality and psychotherapy as well. And I just took to it like a duck to water from then on.
So, but what does it mean? I mean, everyone knows pretty much what psychology is, but what does it mean to be spiritual in that context?
It means to see yourself as much more than just an individual ego in a body, struggling with other egos for power and money and more stuff, everything that doesn't make anybody happy. So you come to see the world in a different way. And this didn't happen to me overnight. I mean, it started in California. I can give you a couple of other things that influenced me later on. I returned to the East Coast because I had a lot of family and friends here, all of them. And although I loved Southern California, I felt like I belonged in New York. So I came back, and I just started reading voraciously. And two of the books that caught my attention early on, one was The Seth Material by Jane Roberts, where a energy gestalt named Seth would give us great psychological and spiritual insight. And I can talk more about that later, because I will. It's all in my book. And then also A Course in Miracles, which came out in 1976. And I started studying that. So those two books completely changed the way I looked at both psychotherapy and my life.
Well, I'm glad you're open to that. They're both, Seth definitely is a channeled being. And I think The Course in Miracles, she sort of tapped into something that was a non-physical presence, the woman who wrote that book. But how can you, maybe you weren't coming from such a traditional background, but how would you explain Jane Roberts sort of, I am being the devil's advocate because I sort of grew up with channeling, but how would you explain that this woman goes into the schizophrenic sort of mode, and this other very strange, very odd voice starts talking through her. I mean, it looks like schizophrenia, I would
yes.
think.
Yes, when you look at it, and I have a VHS tape of it, and it looks like she's psychotic.
Yes.
But what I always tell everybody is, look at the material. Okay? So I'll give you a couple of quotes from the book that really grabbed me immediately. You create your own reality through your beliefs, conscious and unconscious. Period. There is no other rule.
I believe that.
Okay.
I mean,
that's
you don't have to
quote.
Be a channel to say that, but
no,
yeah.
you don't. But this is great material.
It is.
Another one. Your body is your living sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You are the sculptor of your own body. In other words, how healthy or not healthy you are depends entirely on your thoughts, beliefs, and feelings, which, you know, I would have to say I am discovering more and more and more is true, that there is some emotional factor, at least, in every illness. And what I like to help people do is unearth the emotional and psychological factors so they can become more physically healthy as well as more spiritually healthy and psychologically healthy.
I would say that
as a hypnotist, I'm also an Ericksonian hypnotherapist, I would call the states of Jane Roberts spontaneous trance states.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, yeah, there are trance states, and obviously the information is not psychotic or gibberish, as in the case of a lot of people who have deranged minds. There's something very coherent about it. But I'm just curious, how do you explain that phenomena in the context of a worldview that really doesn't include that?
Okay, well, I'm one of these people that intuitively searches for the truth. I've been intuitively searching for the truth all my life. And I have the tremendous, tremendous great good fortune of having even early influences teach me things. My grandfather had discovered some books. The family legend is he got them in a lumber yard. And it was written by a man named Robert Collier called The Secret of the Ages. And it was about the law of attraction. And
right.
it just intuitively seemed right to me. My mother was always talking about the law of attraction. She would say in Greek, because we're Greek Jews, my family, she would say in Greek, everything is all right and everything is going to be all right. And then she would show me Papu's books. And at first I thought, I don't know what this is. But as I got older and started actually reading these books, the sound sounded interesting. So I follow my intuition.
No,
I experiment.
That. I think it's great, and we can talk about some of your experiences, but I'm just trying to bridge that for people who may have a limited worldview. How do we redefine the human being in terms of this larger psycho-spiritual context, is what I'm saying.
Okay, well, my definition of a human being is we are individualizations of a greater consciousness. So we're individual manifestations of a greater consciousness. You can call that greater consciousness God. You can call it the universe. You can call it the Buddha nature. You can call it many things, the source, universal source of energy. Out of that greater consciousness, that grand consciousness that people traditionally call God, human beings are individual manifestations, okay? All matter is an individual manifestation of a central energy source. And quantum physics talks about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just looked at some solid object, you would just say, this is a solid object. That's what your senses tell you. But you know from eighth grade science that it's made up of atoms and molecules of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, right?
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah, yeah,
have
yeah.
Have you ever seen an atom? I never have.
Well,
but we believe in them, right?
I don't think I have. Yeah. Well, we're told we are, so we believe
we're told,
our
right? Well, we're also told there's a God, but some people reject that. And by the way, that's fine with me. If you don't want to use the word God or think there's an energetic source, that's okay. I believe with Dr. Milton Erickson, the greatest psychotherapist of all time, that you invent a new therapy for each patient. So when I'm interviewing
the
patient,
is that what he said? That's very interesting. Yeah,
I mean, take them where they are. I use their language. I use their experiences and whatever they believe in. That's the starting point to where we can help them both with psychology and spirituality.
So, okay, so we're individual expressions, and of course, you're helping people find that individual expression. But let's go to the book you've just written, which is sort of talks about what it's all about. Because what is it all about? The Great Cosmic Lesson Plan.
The Great Cosmic Lesson Plan. The idea came to me about 20 some odd years ago. My daughter was sitting in the car with me, and I was driving her to her bitty basketball game here in Teaneck, New Jersey. I was the coach, and she was one of my players. One of my other players, by the way, is now in the NBA. So this is the range of the team. So suddenly my daughter turns to me and says, "Hey, Dad." I go, "What?" She goes, "What's life for, anyway?" So I felt like Ralph Cramden in that moment. I went, "Hama, hama, 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 hama." It's to love. And she goes, "Really?" And I go, "Yeah, it's to love as many people as you can, as much as you can." And that moment, which, by the way, she doesn't even remember, but it happens. And from then on, I started thinking of life as a great cosmic lesson plan, working toward being more loving of yourself as well as others. It fits right into psychology. Because people that love themselves, and I don't mean in a narcissistic, I only love me sense, and also love others and share this universal kind of love, are the people who have the most fulfilling lives.
Yeah.
And then I extended it to psychotherapy over the years, and I thought, well, what about all the terrible things that happen to people? And what about, you know, famines and wars and diseases and everything that people get? And what I thought was, on the psychological level, we call it cognitive reframing. In other words, you look at it in a different way. So this is what I explain in the book. I'll give you one that happened to me when I was a little kid. When I was 9 years old, I was diagnosed with rheumatic fever, which gave me a heart murmur afterwards. I was confined to bed, was not allowed to get out of bed for 6 months. I missed 6 months of school. We just moved to a new neighborhood. I didn't know anybody. So, you know, you could say that was a terrible thing. And at the time, I did think it was a terrible thing. The doctor came every week. You know, doctors made house calls, took my blood, gave me steroids. That's what they did then. I got cortisone. So here I am, pumped up on steroids, sitting in bed, not allowed to move. So that's pretty bad, right?
Well, yeah, it's not fun. It's
not fun.
Not
it was
fun.
No fun. It was terrible for this little kid who just wanted to go out and play and couldn't even get out of bed. And over the years, I reframed it. Well, what did I do sitting in bed? I did two things, the only two things I really could do. I read and I watched TV. Well, what did I watch on TV? New York had three baseball teams. I was a huge Dodger fan, and I watched the Yankees and the Giants when the Dodgers weren't on, and I became a sports nut. My mother said, "I'll get you books. What do you want from the library?" I said, "Anything on baseball." So I became, not only did I become an expert on baseball, and it became a lifetime interest for me, but I became an 11th grade reader by the 6th grade.
Well, so
I would say that really helped me.
So you reframed your
I reframed it. I also became interested
situation.
In comedies. I watched My Little Margie and Leave It to Beaver and Amos and Andy, and I became more into humor and comedy. Another one of my big interests, which I think is very important in mental health. All because I got sick.
So you reframed an unfortunate situation into a positive situation.
Exactly.
And is that a sort of core aspect of your psychotherapy, is to help people reframe their life?
Yes. The Great Cosmic Lesson Plan is completely reframing your life, and you take it from wherever you're starting with. Everybody comes in some sort of trouble or affliction. Either they're very anxious, or they're having panic attacks, or they're depressed, or they're having relationship difficulties. And by reframing it in terms of, well, what could you get positive out of it? How can you think of this different? This cognitive restructuring, they begin to see that maybe something good could come out of their troubles, and they begin to change, first psychologically, and the ultimate reframe is to look at life spiritually as a great cosmic lesson. Like, that's what we're here for.
So you're saying we're here to do what? What is the actual lesson?
We're here to learn how the nature of reality and how to express that in the physical world through being loving and kind and helpful and becoming a better person and doing the best we can with our troubles and transcending them, and all the while getting hopefully more and more spiritual. So it could be through traditional religion, or it could be through meditation is very important. I talk a lot about meditation in my book. I talk about different techniques that I've developed or some other systems have developed where, there's one thing I teach my patients, three things. Let go of your negative emotion, which is basically anger, fear, and guilt. Then turn it over to God if they believe in God, like let go, let God. And then I teach them to raise their hands and say, I accept healing.
Mm.
So the short version of that, which makes them laugh usually, is an acronym, okay? So it's LUGA, LUGA, LUGA. Ah.
So I have and you share that with them, too.
Yeah, I share that with them and where it comes from. And they inevitably they laugh. And they say, that's great. And from a psychologist's point of view, what I'm doing is cognitive pattern interruption. Mm. Okay? I'm interrupting their negative pattern of being guilty or angry or afraid. And instead, they're laughing because it's funny, because the looga, looga, looga. And the ah actually feels good. If you tried it, try just going ah and lifting your hands. It feels good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're interrupting the negative pattern, the flow, the negative energy, and we're allowing the positive energy, the spiritual energy, to flow.
Wow. I should have introduced a friend of mine to you who just committed suicide. Benefited from that because, you know, some people are just so depressed they refuse to turn around. You know,
right.
They refuse to or somehow they get stuck in or attached to the knot, to keeping it how it is for whatever reason.
Right.
How do you work with some of
those?
Well,
let me tell you a story of a very depressed man, okay, and this is in the book too. Okay, so he came in at first and he was so depressed. His wife had referred me. She had been a patient, and she didn't know what to do with him. And he came, and he was so, so depressed. And one day, he's telling me how he really wanted to kill himself. And I said, all right, what do you think happens when you're dead? He looked at me like I was crazy. I said, what do you think happens? He said, what do you mean? You're dead, you're dead. That's it. I said, well, what if it's something else? He said, what do you mean? I mean, what if your consciousness continues to exist? I mean, a lot of people think that.
There's the rub, as Hamlet said. That was exactly what he said when he said, there's the rub, you know?
Yeah,
you know, dream
right.
of death. Yeah, yes. Okay, so.
There's the rub.
Yeah. What was the next step?
Well, so I said, now, I'm not telling you this is the absolute truth. I'm just telling you what I believe. I said, I believe your consciousness continues to exist. If you're in a very depressed state, continue to be in a depressed state, you just don't have a body. And then because you didn't get your cosmic lesson plan, you have to come back and do it again because I believe in reincarnation. So I'm not going to say he accepted that right away. His first reaction was to become angry with me. He got angry and he stayed angry for a while because I took away his escape hatch. His great escape hatch, that's what I call it, is all right, I'll just kill myself, and then I'll be obliterated, and that'll be it. I won't be suffering anymore. I gave him a different option. You might be suffering just as much or more and have to come back and do it again. So
What would be his lesson plan? What would be his lesson there, necessarily?
Oh, his lesson is to make the best out of what he gets in life. I mean, he's got other afflictions. He's got bad diabetes. He lost a leg. And, you know, difficulties.
How do you make the best out of all those situations? I mean, how do, what
well,
do you
I'll
do?
Tell you, you know, to make a yeah. long story short, this happened a couple of years ago, and he is so much better. He barely has time to come in. He travels. Mm-hmm. He has an artificial limb. He walks with a cane and, you know, and the artificial leg. And he does things. He travels. He goes to the city. He goes to plays. He does everything.
So he's doing, so something really shifted in him to make his life more interesting. He
yes.
was able to let go of that.
That was the one dramatic moment. The other thing I do with this fellow is tell a lot of jokes. Okay, he had a lot of self-pity, so without maligning any group, there was a show called Amos and Andy, which they don't show anymore, and it was very funny, and the chief character, the Kingfish, used to say, woe is me, what is I going to do? So I started quoting that to him. He started cracking up, because he remembered it. He's like my age, like late 60s, and I said, you're not doing the woe is me thing again, are you? You know, and I would kid around with him. And he would always laugh. He would always, even if he came in depressed, he would leave laughing. And I would tell him one-liners, some of which I made up and some of which I got, you know, on the Internet. And, you know, like a mole walked into a bar. And he noticed that the bartender was also a mole, only he was dressed with a tallis and tefillin and a yarmulke. And he said, holy moly! So,
Do you feel, though, I'm just curious on the side, do you feel like then responsible as a therapist for this person's well-being?
No, I wouldn't say I'm responsible. My responsibility is to be as loving and kind, as compassionate, and use my skills to help the person reframe their life, to cognitively reframe it, psychologically think things through and come up with different conclusions, develop a sense of humor about their life and life in general, and eventually, hopefully, become spiritual about it.
Well, when you say become spiritual, what do you mean? Like see human existence as only an aspect of the totality of beingness, would you say?
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. That beingness is way more than just your one individual physical life. That we are a greater consciousness. We're all part of that greater consciousness. And the more you realize that, this is where meditation comes in. The more you get to this quiet space that Wayne Dyer called getting in the gap, the spiritual quiet space, which I get to through meditation, and I teach people to meditate, and I encourage them to go to meditation groups if they can. And the more they do that, the more you get into the space where you want to help others, where you want to do good things, where you want to feel good, and you also want to be happy, and you want to share your happiness with others. This is like the ultimate, you know, successful psychotherapy, because your life has become much better.
Yeah, no, it sounds great. You know, I just saw another really good channel called Paul Selig. You know who Paul Selig is? The book of Knowing and Worth. I think that's something you might resonate with.
Okay, sounds good.
But I want to ask you one more question about Viktor Frankl, where he says life must have some meaning.
I remember him saying that to us. But life must have a meaning.
What does that mean? Just in a meaning that exists beyond us, if we think of ourselves as spiritual beings, or is it meaning as a human being?
Well, Dr. Frankl took it to mean there's many different ways. One way was spiritual values, but there was also something called aesthetic values or transcendent values. He had all different kinds of values. Like he found meaning by helping the other prisoners in Auschwitz because he was a medical doctor. And he found meaning in the sunset, even though the Nazis couldn't take the sunset away. You know,
so that's a meaning he imposed on his situation. It's not an empirical meaning.
Right. He was an existentialist. He felt we create our own meanings. And he gave us all kinds of ideas on how to create meanings.
But that's sort of in direct sort of conflict to this cosmic lesson plan, which, because it seems like, I mean, it just seems like you're implying that the real meaning is something larger than the one that we are imposing on it from our human perception.
Well, I'm saying that ultimately that's where we're going. But there are so many layers and levels of that we can take from human life, including, of course, the physical ones, that the whole thing, the whole of life, is this lesson plan. And depending on where you are, like Milton Erickson said, you start from where you are. Okay? You might start from being an atheist, and you're just depressed. And so you work your way out of the depression cognitively, and then you get to the next level. And maybe you get to where the existentialists were, where you need to find some meaning in life, like Frankl or Sartre. And they still weren't spiritual about it. Frankl was, Sartre was not. And then you might get to another level where you reach that oneness in meditation, and you say, you know, there is something cosmic. So I like to call it that you are co-creators of your reality. We are all co-creators. By working with our beliefs and improving them, we have a better life. As we have a better life and we start to meditate and get into the oneness, we might call it a spiritual life, and so on and so forth. So there's many levels.
Well, I think it's great that, you know, an organization like ASP, Association for Spirituality Psychotherapy, is now providing a forum for people like you. Of course, you were past president, to come forward and mix these approaches together.
Is there anything you want to say? ASP is a great organization. I was one of the founders. I ran into Henry Grayson and Diana and Bruce Karievsky at a conference, and I was asked, you know, I like them all, and I was asked to come to a meeting. I said, when's the meeting? They said, Thursday at 2 o'clock in New York. I'm like, what? You expect me to leave my office and come to New York for an hour meeting at 2 o'clock? You know, that was the beginning of it. Henry was the first president. I was the second.
Well, great. I mean, thanks for spending a little time here.
Yeah. I just want to mention one more thing. It's a very, very appropriate day for me to be interviewed about this, because I signed an agreement today. I completed an agreement with Balboa Press. So my new book will be published in the spring by Balboa Press. So.
This great cosmic lesson plan?
Yes.
Oh, it's going to be. I was going to ask you how people can find it. So you're saying in the spring?
It's not out yet, but in the spring they can get it at Balboa Press website or Amazon or Barnes and Noble or any of these places. It'll be available as download, paperback, or hardback, whatever they like.
The Great Cosmic Lesson Plan.
Right. And the subtitle is Healing Through Spirituality, Humor, and Music.
Sam Menahan. Would you have a website, a personal website?
Yeah,
Dr.
Menahem, M-E-N-A-H-E-M, drmenahem.com. And they can read the article this book is based on. It's on there.
I appreciate your approach, the humor and the spirituality. I mean, that's exactly what I think we need more of, especially in situations that people are troubled, emotionally troubled.
Yeah.
So thanks so much. I hope to see you somewhere, Sam.
You're going to see me if you come to the ASP Christmas party. I'm coming.
I will be there, and I'll let you know also when this is up online.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks,
All
Sam.
Right. Good night.
I'm talking
Bye.
To Sam Menahem, former president of the Association for Spirituality Psychotherapy. I have another guest coming up right now who's also a former president of the Association for Spirituality Psychotherapy, Bernie Starr. Doug, did you get that note about the next guest? Yes, he did get that note. And I think we're going to try to get Bernie on the line here. And Bernie's also written a new book, which he's going to tell us about after we kind of cover the initial understanding of what this organization is about, the Association for spirituality psychotherapy, ASPHealing.org. You can find that online, and along with these interviews. And okay, it looks like we do have Bernie online. Bernie, are you there?
Yes, this is me. I'm here.
Okay, I am talking to Bernard Starr, whose latest book is Jesus, Jews, and Anti-Semitism in Art. But before we get to the book, let's talk a little bit about your approach of bringing spirituality into psychotherapy. Where's that come from, and how do you work with that?
Big backstory to that.
A little bit of the big backstory.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, most of my career was in teaching at City University of New York, Brooklyn College, developmental psychology in the School of Education. And at the same time, I had a practice in psychotherapy and was trained by a well-known analyst. And like many, did a variety of therapies derived basically from a Freudian approach. I think most Western psychologies are based on strengthening the ego. It's all about ego. And at some point, I got disenchanted with that. It just seemed to me that there was something not working. As I saw other therapists working, they were not getting the results that they hoped for, and I became disenchanted with it until I stumbled into Eastern traditions and became enamored of it and realized that there is a consciousness beyond the ego that Western psychology had just bypassed, and still does for the most part. So I got into that, and I got involved in primal therapy at one point, had an institute with Armand DeMille, the Institute of the Dynamic Affective Psychotherapies, in which we brought together all of the affective approaches to psychotherapy. This goes back to the 70s. And then I integrated that into a more spiritual approach that focused on higher consciousness, on a consciousness beyond the ego.
How did you open up to that fact that there was something beyond the ego?
How did I open up to it?
Yeah, you're very steeped in Freudian, like blah, 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 and how did you finally discover this thing beyond the ego?
By stumbling into some of the great writers of Eastern tradition, like Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj, and then I started attending some spiritual groups and got deeper and deeper into it. Eventually, I wrote a book about it, about the different consciousness called "Escape Your Own Prison: Why We Need Spirituality and Psychology to Be Truly Free." I've been through a whole process of evolution. Now I'm more interested in writing and teaching because I find individual therapy less effective than getting people to grasp this other kind of consciousness, this higher consciousness. And I think that that is the big task of spiritual psychology, is to get people to shift their focus, because we're all brought up on ego psychology, more or less. And as one of the great teachers today, Muji, who I think is one of the really outstanding Advaita teachers, he characterizes Western psychology and traditional psychology, the ego approaches, by asking a question of how do you treat a toothache in a ghost?
That's interesting.
And essentially, when you think about it, that's what most ego psychological approaches is doing, that it's treating a toothache in a ghost. It's treating an illusionary, constructed self.
Right. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
no.
At any rate, that's kind of where I am. How I drifted into my study of Jesus and anti-Semitism is a whole other thing.
Well, no, because I'm curious. So, so you're not teaching so much, and you have gotten into this other thing that we can talk about now. But, I mean, thank you for laying that foundation about your history and your approach and your kind of movement towards spirituality. So you've written two books now about Jesus. I mean, this is your second one.
Right, and I kind of stumbled into that. It actually started when Mel Gibson came out with that film, The Passion of the Christ, mm-hmm. and I attended a debate between two rabbis, actually. And I was just struck by why this confusion still lingers about who killed Jesus and blaming the Jews throughout history. So it got me involved in actually reading the New Testament that I knew very little about. And I realized, as I discovered later, that many scholars, Christian and Jewish, had discovered this, that the New Testament is really a document all about Jews. And for
right.
Jews.
I tell everyone it's the Italians that killed Jesus, and it was their karma then to
well,
host.
Well, you know, there's divided opinion about that, but what I like to point out all the time, despite all the divided opinion, and now the predominance of the opinion is with Bill O'Reilly's book and several others, Reza Aslan, that the Romans did it. They characterized Jesus. He was kind of a Rambo character. He was trying to oppose Rome, and the Romans did it. Well, isn't that interesting? Because I can't find a single case over the last 2,000 years of anybody riding through a town and screaming out, you know, get those descendants of the Romans, those Christ killers. And Jews were charged with that for 2,000 years and with deadly consequences. So regardless of the debate and the conclusion that is reached, the Jews were always blamed. And the story itself, we don't have the time to go into it, the whole story about the crucifixion, as it's laid out in the New Testament, is leading to, you know, blaming Judas and the Jews in general, is kind of a bizarre story when you get out down to it. And I have outlined that in my book and in several articles. In fact, the second book that just came out, the one that you mentioned on art, is actually a collection of all my articles that I wrote over the last year or year and a half related to the book, because I discovered that art really contributed to a lot of the negativity toward Jews by separating Jesus from Judaism when Jesus was a thoroughly practicing Jew. He lived, died as a Jew, didn't start a new religion. That came later. But there's a general belief that he didn't. And Renaissance artists turned him into a Renaissance-era fair-skinned Northern European Christian, surrounded by Christian artifacts, Christian saints. And that strengthened and reinforced that view that Jews and Jesus were of different religions and ethnicities. And I think that that is one of the overlooked underpinnings of historic anti-Semitism, by setting up that dichotomy.
That divorcing Jesus from his Jewish background, his Jewish
right.
heritage.
And by the way, I've said this, and a lot of Jews don't like it, that Jews really contributed to this identity theft, because they rejected Jesus right from the beginning, when in fact he was a dedicated Jew. It's one thing to say, well, okay, we don't accept him as Messiah, but the fact is he was a dedicated Jew. But they were kind of glad to get rid of him. Okay, you guys want him, and you deny his Jewish heritage? Great, terrific. And they did not realize the lethal consequences of that, that it was a setup for anti-Semitism, because in establishing that Jesus and Jews were different and that the Jews killed him, you know, that led to many of the persecutions throughout history.
Well, also the fact that Jews like to keep themselves separate from other people, they tend to isolate, you know.
Well, so exactly. They were looking the other way, and they said, okay, you want them, you know, take them and just leave us alone. And they didn't realize that that kind of isolationism that you're talking about, that self-absorption, contributed to much of the anti-Semitism that took place. So Jews are not blameless in this identity theft and the separation between Judaism and Christianity. And I think there's a need to bring that together, for Jews and Christians to come together to realize there's a common foundation there.
Well, you know that guy who wrote the book Rabbi Jesus?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Bruce Chilton.
Bruce Chilton, nice
Father
guy.
Father Bruce Chilton, an Anglican priest.
Mm-hmm. Right, but he still considers, even though he he loves the Jewish aspect of Jesus, he still considers himself a Christian. Which
well, you
I
know,
couldn't...
that's interesting because early on when I got involved in this, I went to a debate at the Jewish History Society on 16th Street, and he was one of the on a panel with two other people, one a Catholic scholar from Chicago and a rabbi who also has written on Jesus, and all of them proclaimed that Jesus was thoroughly Jewish. He was Jewish to the core. He lived and died a Jew. So I, during the Q&A, I raised my hand and I addressed it to Bruce Chilton, and I said, "Well, you've convinced me, Professor Hilton, that Jesus was thoroughly Jewish. So, you know, why aren't you a Jew?"
Right, right. I asked him that too.
So he squirmed a little bit because he obviously set himself up for that. And, you know, then he gave the traditional answer, well, but then with the coming of Jesus and the resurrection, et cetera, that it set a new path. But
there's a tradition of resurrection or raising the dead in the mystical Jewish traditions, the tzaddiks, you know, the righteous ones.
Well, that's
ones,
true. Even the Pharisees. The Pharisees believed in resurrection, and it's right there in the New Testament. And Jesus was a Pharisee. So the whole notion of resurrection is really not foreign to Judaism and certainly within mystical Judaism.
Right. But tell me, what do you think of Jesus? Not as far as a Messiah or anything, but was he an enlightened, an awakened, divine emanation? What's your personal belief?
Well, you know, there's so little factually about Jesus that it leaves open an opportunity for people to speculate. There's big gaps. You know, we first learn about him at the nativity. He's born. The next time he appears, he's 12 years old, debating the rabbis at the temple. Then he disappears for 18 years and shows up at age 30, getting baptized by John the Baptist in the River Jordan. And then 3 years later, he's crucified. So there's big gaps there, and it leaves open, you know, a lot of speculation and opportunities for spin. But I think that from what's written there, and particularly what's come out in these other Gnostic Gospels that have surfaced from the desert and caves, that he was really an Advaita teacher, and that what you read about him in the New Testament is what just one level of his teachings. I mean, all you know that all spiritual teachers have different levels of teaching,
right.
Because they speak to and teach at a level that who they're speaking to can understand.
Right. Yes. So the fundamentalist beliefs are not seeing the transcend. They're seeing the Jesus they want to see. Of course. I mean, I guess everyone sees what they want to see. But the
well, that's true. That's true. But still, the I've been have made several appearances on Christian radio with evangelical ministers, and I have no problem with them, and they have no problem with me. They accept Jesus as you know, as Jewish. But then, like Father Chilton, they say, well, after the resurrection, that set a new direction. But the problem is getting Jews to warm up to Jesus, actually. And that's why in my first book on Jesus Uncensored, I have a chapter called The Jesus Phobia, which a lot of Jews won't like either, in which I call on them to, you know, to drop it, because I've yet to find any sizable number of Jews who have read the New Testament.
Well,
when
you know,
I give talks
to
Jewish groups, I ask them what they think of Jesus, and of course they condemn him, and he's responsible for this and for that. And I say to them, you know, name one thing that Jesus did that harmed Jews or anybody. And of course they can't come up with anything. And then I ask, well, how many of you have actually read the New Testament? And in one group I addressed, not a single person there had read the New Testament, but they had very firm convictions. Negative
right.
convictions about
well,
Jesus.
Well, I know that because I was brought up Jewish, and you wouldn't even mention Jesus' name until I started to explore different spiritual traditions and then looked at some of the sayings. Well, actually, first through the Gospel of Thomas, which I think is a real enlightened text.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, there's a lot of wisdom here and there's a lot of love here. Maybe Jesus isn't such a bad guy, and maybe I'll look into that. And I found him. I mean, you know, I tell everyone he was Jewish, a Jewish enlightened mystic, and you know, that's who we are, Bernie.
Yeah, well, Jews still, for the most part, cringe at the name Jesus. In fact, when I went to see the Shekel exhibit at the Jewish Museum this past year, and Chagall did lots of crucifixion paintings in which he pictured the crucifixion as representing the suffering of Jews. So his Jesus is Jewish and Christian. It's Jesus on the cross, but often he's pictured really, rather than in a loincloth, wearing a tallis. And he has many of them. Half of the exhibit were crucifixion paintings. When I walked in there, there was this Orthodox Hasidic rabbi there staring at this very big, impressive crucifix painting of Jesus called Fallen Angel. So I was very curious. I went up to him and I said, well, you know, what do you think about that? And he looked at me kind of suspiciously, so I kind of indicated to him that I was Jewish, that I write for one of the Jewish publications. And I still had to press him and press him and press him. And finally he said, well, he said, it's very, very troubling, but he wouldn't elaborate anymore.
What was troubling exactly?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. What was troubling is the idea of any kind of connection between Christianity and Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
For him, and I'm saying that that's exactly where the trouble began, by Jews rejecting Jesus. They left open the path to Christians then to hijack him completely, erase his Judaism. In the Renaissance paintings, you will find no evidence at all of Jesus being a Jew. And I'm saying that is anti-Semitism by omission, because it set up one of the overlooked underpinnings of anti-Semitism by separating, by seeing Jesus as different than the Jews. And quite interestingly, in Renaissance paintings, when they do paint Jews, the others, like in Albrecht Dürer's paintings, they're not Northern Europeans, I can assure you that. They're dark, they're menacing, they're ugly. And they're the others, they're the Jews. And then Jesus is always blonde and ethereal-looking, and he's one of us, you know, the Christians.
Right, so when did this separation, I'm sure it started early on, because, I mean, the early Christian churches were aspects of the Jewish
religion. Well, yes,
religion.
That's very true. I think it got ratcheted up in the 4th century when the Council of Nicaea established Christianity as a separate religion. And at that point, you're perfectly right, much of the populace, the so-called Jewish Christian population, many of the converts, they didn't really understand the difference between Judaism and Christianity, and many of them were still worshiping in synagogues. And I think that that prompted the church to start ratcheting up its attack on Judaism, its demonization of Judaism, to get them to stop, to separate from Judaism completely. And that's when the blood libel charges started. That's when they started with the argument that, well, you know, the Jews collectively killed Jesus, and many other charges against Jews.
No, Chilton, Bruce Chilton, actually, and I think it's in my interview with him, he says it was the burning of the Second Temple that really divided Judaism, because there was no, from Christianity, because there was no foundation for Judaism anymore. So they built these synagogues and, for the Jews.
Well, you're talking about 70 A.D. At that time, it was, you know, at the end of Paul's ministry, and at that point, most of the converts were pagans. But you still had the, you know, quite interestingly, the disciples of Jesus after the crucifixion, they continued as Jews. They thought that that celebrating Jesus and the resurrection was just the fulfillment of Jewish prophecy, and that they were Jews, and Jesus was at the helm, and they continued to worship in the temple in Jerusalem. And there was a big divide then between the brand of Judaism of the disciples of Jesus and what Paul was preaching in Greece and Rome and Asia Minor. But you see, the destruction of the temple destroyed that Jewish Christianity that was based in Jerusalem, because the Jews, 500,000 were killed in that war. They were banished from Jerusalem for a period of time, and the whole Jewish-Christian community was wiped out, and that gave this Western Pauline Christianity kind of open field running.
Was Paul a Jew, or was he?
He was. He not only was he a Jew, he was a very Orthodox Jew at the beginning. He lived and studied at the temple in Jerusalem under one of the most famous rabbis of the period, Gamaliel II, and he was a persecutor of the Christians originally. He had letters from the Sanhedrin that authorized him to travel as far as Damascus to bring back apostate Jews who were preaching Jesus in synagogues, and he would drag them back to Jerusalem for trial. And it was on one of those journeys to Damascus that he had his conversion, where he's, you know, went into this trance. Some say it was an epileptic fit, and he had a vision of Jesus, and then he was a devotee of Jesus after that, and then became, as many people believe, the founder of Christianity as a separate religion.
Right. There must be something about Jesus. I mean, people are still having visions of Jesus. I mean, of course, it could be just be the human psychological trait to project a vision onto a deity of sorts. You know, although Jesus was just a human being, and but people
whether he was or not, people believe in it, and it has inspired people. Every time I write an article about Jesus, there's always these attack dogs, you know, on the internet. I'm sure you've experienced it. That say, "Oh, why are you even bothering to talk about this? Jesus never existed. The whole thing is fantasy and whatnot." And when I do respond to these people, I say, "Well, but you know, there's a billion Christians around." I said, "That's real. They're here. Christianity through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and the Church and all of that, it's real. The persecution of the Jews by Christ, that was real. So, I mean, what's the point of saying it's not real? No matter what it was founded on, it is a reality, and it has been a reality through much of history.
Right. What do you think of Dan Brown and the other people, or the Holy Blood, that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene?
Well, you know, that's an ongoing speculation.
Is there anything to that?
There's so many gaps, and I've written extensively about that. And just a few weeks ago, there was a new book published about Jesus, saying that not only was he married to Mary Magdalene, but he had two children, boys, in this account, two sons.
Sophia and James.
This is a new one based on a 6th century text that this author discovered. In this story, he had two sons. It's been widely rejected and criticized at this point. But any speculation about Jesus that departs from the New Testament characterization is attacked by the Church and devotees of Jesus. We know that that in Judaism, celibacy was certainly not something that was sought or honored. All the great rabbis were married, and Jews followed the Old Testament dictum: go forth and multiply.
Was he a rabbi? Is there evidence?
Well, people called him rabbi, and rabbis in that time, they didn't go to rabbinical school or anything like that. It was much more informal. So teachers and people who had followings were called rabbi, and in the New Testament, he's addressed as rabbi.
Oh, I see. Now,
in fact, quite interestingly, for the and proving Bruce Chilton's point that this is a Jewish document, the term Jew and Jews appears 202 times in the New Testament, 82 times in the Gospels, and the Gospels cover his life and ministry. And the term Christian, it does not appear at all in the Gospels during Jesus' lifetime, and in the rest of the New Testament, it only appears 3 times.
Wait, I wasn't really that familiar. So the gospel, there are 4 gospels that make up the New Testament.
No, Testament consists of 27 books. The first 4 books are the gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Right.
Okay, and that covers the life and ministry of Jesus. Then the next book in the New Testament is Acts of the Apostles, and that's the story of Paul, you know, post-resurrection.
Oh,
and then the rest of it consists of many of the epistles of Paul's, his letters and several other epistles of others, and then the Apocalypse of John, which is the
It does seem like the God of Jesus, the God of the New Testament, is a very different God than the jealous God of the Old Testament. How do you reconcile those two things?
Orthodox Jews would argue that point with you and would say that the God of the Old Testament is many faceted. They would argue that it's a God of love, it's a God of protection, it's a God of promise for Judaism.
It's also an angry God, a jealous
and
God.
But it's a jealous God and it's an angry God, but the Christian God can be punishing also. I mean, isn't that what many of the ministers say? I mean,
well, that's because they're quoting the Old
Christianity also elaborated on hell. You know, what's that all about?
They're still referring to the Old Testament, but if you follow the teachings of Jesus, it seems like God is more loving, and it's the loving
spirit.
Well,
that's true. That's true, and that's, by the way, what appealed to converts and what Paul used to... I mean, many of the early converts to Christianity were the lower classes and slaves, because what they found appealing was the principle of equality in Christianity, that the idea of eternal life, that everybody is equal under God. And that was very appealing. Obviously, if you were a slave, that could be very appealing.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that's what was very threatening to Rome, also, because it was so appealing to slaves and to the lower classes.
But I want to get back to your major point here about the book by reclaiming Jesus as a Jew with Jewish origins and a fulfillment of Judaism. How does that then have a larger effect?
Well, it obviously brings on a reconciliation between the two faiths, showing that there's a strong common ground and a common heritage. There may be certain doctrinal differences, but remember that Christianity is based on Jewish prophecy. That is part of the love-hate relationship that Christianity always had, and that was part of the difficulty in separating from Judaism. Jesus had to be of the Davidic line to be the Messiah, so the Gospel of Matthew goes to great lengths at the beginning to give you the whole genealogy going back to David. And to Abraham, even, and then he had to be a Jew, and that's why he was circumcised on the eighth day, as prescribed in the Torah. So there's a strong connection between the two. In fact, I'm always amused, especially around Christmas time, because we were talking about the Jewish kind of the rejection, shunning, and the phobia of Jesus, how people shudder when they see those the scenes of Jesus' birth and nativity scenes on their neighbors' lawns, you know,
yeah.
And they, oh, you know, that's so Christian. But that's a thoroughly Jewish scene. That's the birth of a Jewish boy to a Jewish couple. Mary and Joseph were totally practicing Jews. It's right there in the Old Testament. They traveled the arduous trip to the temple in Jerusalem to celebrate all of the major Jewish holidays. Okay.
Right.
And in the Gospel of Luke, after Jesus is born, she waits 30 days and then goes to the temple for the purification ceremony that's required of Jewish women after they give birth. It's prescribed by the Torah. You know, so that nativity scene is a thoroughly Jewish scene.
Well,
there's nothing Christian about it whatsoever, and yet Jews, oh my God, you know, that's Christian. And they
I'm
going to
put you on a lot of these upcoming Christmas shows, okay? You could talk about that. These Christmas, because
the whole antagonism historically between Judaism and Christianity was really invented by the leadership of both Judaism and Christianity. And, you know, the people got sucked into this. And, I mean, imagine during the Middle Ages, if you were a Christian and you're going to church on Holy Friday to celebrate the crucifixion of Jesus, and you hear about the suffering of Jesus on the cross, and the priests and the nuns and the monks, they tell you that the Jews did it, you know, and then they may read one of these poems about the blood libel, about how Jews killed Christian children at Passover to use their blood for making matzah. Right. And, you know, so they would come out of the church service and looking to do havoc on Jews because, you know, one of the things, interestingly, that the church did for 1,000 years, and Christians, when I tell them this, always think I'm making it up until I send them the references on it, and that is that from the 4th century onward through the Middle Ages, the church forbid people to own or read the Bible on their own, and they forbid, with the threat of being burned at the stake, and several people were, forbid translating it into native languages. So the Christian populace through most of history never read the New Testament, and I believe that one of the reasons why the church sequestered it and didn't want them to read it and just told them stories that they wanted them to hear from the New Testament, because they didn't want them to see how Jewish the whole thing was. I mean, imagine if they these people, if they read the Bible, and they, and I'm quoting now from the Gospel of Luke, that on the Sabbath, Jesus went back to his place of birth in Nazareth and went to the synagogue as usual, and stood up for the read. Mm-hmm. You know, that he read, as Jews do today, the weekly portion of the Torah.
Well, he went home to visit his mother and figured he'd go to the temple just while he was in town.
Yeah, but they said, as usual. He went every Saturday. He was in the synagogue reading the what's called the Pasha, because Jews read the entire New Testament, Old Testament, weekly, and do cover the whole Old Testament, five books of Moses, over the period of a year.
Right, right.
And he did that all the time, and it's right there. So do you think that the Christians that are desperately trying to separate from Judaism wanted their people to read that?
Right. But I want to get back to the idea of the Messiah, where you said it was predicted, and that's where Christians look to the Old Testament to make an excuse for their religion. Otherwise, it wouldn't have a validation without the Jewish religion. So what is the concept of the Messiah in general, as in the old tradition, and then how people say Jesus fulfilled that role?
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's the point of dispute between Jews and Christians. The reason why Jews reject Jesus as the Messiah is that, according to the most popular view or definition of the Messiah by Maimonides, is that the Jewish, which the Messiah was supposed to bring on the Golden Age and the resurrection of the dead, and et cetera, whatever else goes with
and that's in the Old Testament. That's in Isaiah or something, is it?
Well, it's in many places in the Old Testament. But according to Maimonides, that you can't have a dead Messiah. That the Messiah, that anybody can claim, you know, contrary to what some of the people say about that they wanted, that the Sanhedrin condemned Jesus because he said he's the Messiah. First, it's questionable whether he said he was the Messiah. But even so, some modern rabbis have said, well, you know, there's nothing blasphemous about anybody could be the Messiah. You want to say you're the Messiah, fine, but before you die, you have to deliver to be the Messiah.
Deliver the Golden Age.
Yes, and Jesus didn't. But of course, for the Christians, their answer to that is, well, he's going to do it in the second coming.
Right.
Okay,
so
that's why they celebrate the second coming. So Jesus, they believe, is the Messiah, but he didn't deliver, but he's going to do it in the second coming. And the Jesus said, no, that's not the deal, that you got to do it before you die. But quite interestingly, and you may be familiar with this, Rabbi Schneerson of the Hasidic Jews, many of his followers, and he died several years ago, they believe that he's the Messiah. If you drive through or walk through Crown Heights in Brooklyn, you will see signs stretched across the streets saying, Reb Schneerson, the Mashiach, meaning the Messiah. Well, quite interestingly, Jews have always rejected and ridiculed this notion of the second coming. But those people who believe that Schneerson is the Messiah, they are inadvertently validating the principle of the second coming, because he didn't deliver it before he died. So how is he going to do it? Well, he'll have to do it in the second coming. And my view is, hey, look, let's forget about the Messiah business. It's been very divisive. If Jesus comes back and delivers the golden age, we'll all have to recognize it, right? We'll have to say,
who's coming back, because this idea of the Christ, I mean, his name wasn't Jesus Christ. His name wasn't even Jesus. It was Yeshua, Ben Yosef. And the Christ
aspect. Christians do believe that
he
will come back and deliver the golden age. And I say, if he does that, who wouldn't then worship? And then we would all have to say, well, he's the one. If Schneerson comes back and he does it, well, everybody will have to.
Well,
if a guy named Al comes back and delivers it, we'll have to say Al's the guy. Or if a gal named Jane comes back and brings the golden age, we'll have to say, well, she's the one.
I mean, it's all a projection of a of a kind of metaphor, in a sense, because what I've learned through the great teachers I have is that the divinity, the second coming, is the realization in each one of us of our divine or Christ nature.
Okay, but
it's
you're giving a more Advaita kind of spin on this, which really transcends traditional Judaism or Christianity. You're saying that that the golden age is really ascending to a higher consciousness. And
the kingdom of heaven is within. I think Jesus even said that. So
well,
he's not
I think that's what the Gnostic Gospels say, and that's what the Church has rejected.
I'm a Gnostic. I agree with the Gnosticism and the knowing that we are the divine aspects. And I think Jesus is someone, is my belief about Jesus, someone who was an example of who realized their divinity, and
yes, but from the Christian perspective, that would be blasphemy.
Well, you could say that,
and that's why they burned the Gnostic Gospel.
It would be blasphemy as well. So, they both have that in common.
And by the way, that would be a very unifying principle, because some spiritual teachers say that that's a principle that is at the core of all spiritual traditions, that principle of oneness, that all is one.
Well, I think if you really look at the teachings of Jesus, I should pull out my Gospel of Thomas, he is saying that when you make the up is a down, the right is a left, the man is a woman, when the eye be single, the body will be full of light. He's talking about this union with the totality, with all of
well,
reality.
Well, if he said that, but again, the Christians will tell you, the Christian theologians will say that those Gospels are fabrications, that they're a fake. They do not represent what Jesus said. However, many people believe that that is the more authentic teaching.
Well, if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls and the
Nag Hammadi Library of the
New and Old Testament, you see that even before the 4th century, there were Gospels that were different than the ones that were codified
unfortunately, so many of them were destroyed and burned. Hopefully, more of them will turn up in the, in the desert, as the Nag Hammadi Library did, and that barely showed up. That was almost destroyed by the people who found it.
But I think you're on the right track. I think religion, though, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, they're all in the way of knowing our true spiritual nature.
Well, exactly. And that is principally what I'm trying to do here in with my art exhibit, by the way.
Because
you didn't give the subtitle of my book. Jesus, the Jews, and Anti-Semitism in Art, How Renaissance Art Erased Jesus' Jewish Identity, and How Today's Artists Are Restoring It. I am organizing an art exhibit, and I have 9 talented artists who are doing new renditions of those Renaissance paintings, putting the Judaism back in the picture to show two sides of the Jesus story. Jesus, the dedicated Jew, and Jesus, whose life and teachings inspired a new religion.
Well, where is that art show? When is that happening?
Well, so far, well, in my new book, I have several examples. The last two chapters are about the art show, and I have several. I have examples from each of the artists of at least one of their renditions that bring that express both Judaism and Christianity.
Oh, so it's not a public, it's not a place you can.
Well, I'm hoping that with the publication of the book and my articles, that I will draw a major venue to do the exhibit. I mean, there's lots of galleries that would be willing to do it, but I'm hoping for really a major museum to take this on. But it's a kind of an uphill fight to deal with the art historians who are very rigid in their views. But I'm beginning to gain traction. There are articles coming out recognizing the validity of what I'm doing, and I hope that that will increasingly gain traction and attention. The book just came out last week, this one on Jesus and Renaissance art. So,
how can people find the book? Where can they
Well,
find it?
Well, on Amazon.
Okay.
Initially, I'm just doing it as an e-book because I can have so many, because I could put it up at a very low price, which I did, like $2.98 or so. I can have all of these fabulous hyperlinks in there and actual photographs of some of the paintings that I cite that that erase Jesus' Jewish identity and some of the new renditions. By the way, how this got off the ground when I, in one of my articles, suggested this art exhibit, I got an email from a guy in Canada who is an artist and an architect. In fact, he worked on the Museum of the American Indian in Washington, but he's also an artist. And he said, I like your article very much. And he said, you know, some of my relatives in Renaissance Italy commissioned many of those paintings, and I'd like to take a shot at repainting some of them. And his name is Rod Borghese, and he's a descendant of the Renaissance banking Borghese family that did commission many of these paintings. And, of course, the Borghese Gallery in Rome is one of the great art museums in the world. So he's one of my lead artists in the exhibit. He's done quite a few paintings of new renditions of some of those Renaissance paintings that put Judaism back. And I'll give you one example, if you'd like.
Sure.
Michael Patch's 15th century painting called The Betrothal of the Virgin. It's a wonderful painting by Michael Patcher, who in it, Joseph and Mary are being married or betrothed, and it's, you know, they're fair-skinned, they're blonde, and it's in a Romanesque setting, in a kind of Renaissance setting. And who's officiating it over it? Some high church official. Looks like a pope, and it's surrounded by Christian artifacts and everything. It's a Christian ceremony. Here, this Jewish couple from Galilee, a 13-year-old girl and her her carpenter husband, transformed into Renaissance-era Christians in a total Christian setting.
They always did that. I mean,
well, but it's a total falsification of history,
Sure.
And it runs across all of the Renaissance art. So at any rate, Rod Borghese repainted it, where the official doing the ceremony is a rabbi, and the setting is much more Jewish. And when you see these two paintings side by side, it's unarguable that his isn't Michael Patcher's quality of painting, perhaps, but it's obviously more authentic. It's unarguable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have another question for you, because you also mention in here the diaspora, and I've always contended that I wasn't really of Semitic background, even though I was Jewish, but part of the Khazars, the 13th tribe that converted in the 10th century and became integrated into the Jewish population, but they were really not connected to the Jews of Palestine at all because they adopted the religion. So mm-hmm. I think the Ashkenazi Jews that come out of Eastern Europe are not necessarily part of that diaspora to begin with.
Well, you know, they came from so many different places and were dispersed so often because of the expulsions that, you know, there were a load of expulsions The one that's most popular, of course, is the expulsion from Spain in 1492. But that was just one of many. I mean, they were expelled from France several times, from England. So the dispersions took place all over the place. And that's why I included the article that I wrote based on an interview with Ben Frank, who wrote a book about current remote Jewish communities around the world in faraway places, even like Tahiti. Okay,
uh-huh.
Cuba. So what you're saying has some truth to it, but
sure,
it doesn't mean that that all of them came from another source, because the Jews
95% of the world's Jews are Ashkenazi, you know, and they are from
But again, if you study the history of the diaspora and how Jews were constantly moving and trying to find a place where they could be more acceptable. But of course, you know, the whole notion of race and ethnicity is a confusing one, because there's no such thing as a pure race. You know? I mean, the whole notion is ridiculous.
Well, it's another thing that separates people from each other. I think it's ridiculous too, but. You know,
well, I've always said that almost every anthropologist and scientist will say that that humans came out of Africa, that the original humans of the species were black.
Right.
You know, so that means that we're all black in some sense. So let's just declare everybody black and get on with our business and forget about this whole ridiculous thing about racial differences.
Right. I mean, sure, when we meet beings from another planet, it's not going to matter if we're black or white or yellow. That's what
for sure.
I go with that whole thing. But the other key point I want to talk to you is about the, what do they call these fundamentalist Christians that are really pro-Israel, and they say...
Oh, the evangelicals you're talking
about? Yeah, the evangelicals, and they're sort of hooked up with the fundamentalist Jews, the Hasids, and they're... they're sort of aligned with this, destroying the Islamic sites in Jerusalem and rebuilding the temple, because when you rebuild the temple,
is destroying any sites. I mean, that goes against the Jewish principles that they don't destroy sites.
I know, but they want to rebuild the temple, which is right where the Dome of the Rock, which is, you know, the third holiest site.
Well, you know, over the centuries, there's been...
So there's this whole thing about rebuilding... Yeah.
There's been many proposals to rebuild the temple, but it's never been done, and some people feel it's not likely that it ever will be done, that that with the destruction of the temple, the whole rabbinic Judaism arose, and that's the new Judaism.
Mm. But how do they feel about your Jewish Jesus thing, the evangelicals?
Oh, the evangelicals love it. It's the Orthodox Jews that give me problems. I publish my articles in one of the Jewish publications, and many do see the point, and certainly the less Orthodox and the less conservative, and certainly the Reform Jews and the cultural Jews are with me all the way. But some of the Orthodox, there's one who constantly jumps on my articles, and on one of them, in response, he wrote that he has a whole group of rabbis who are praying for my soul.
Well, you know, I think there's good aspects of every religion. Certainly, you know, Islam is a beautiful religion, and it's about surrender and love, and Christianity is about, you know, the true teachings of Jesus is about love your neighbor as yourself. All these religions, I think, are in the way of what's truly human, you know?
Well, you can say that all of these religions, including Islam at the core, represent true spiritual principles. The problem, though, is that the people often who get in the power positions and then transform it in a way that serves their own needs violates all of those principles.
Well, sure. Look at the Crusades. You know, the first Crusade wasn't about capturing the Holy Land. It was wiping out the Cathars in France.
Well, that's true. And that's why, by the way, in my first book on Jesus Uncensored, I have a chapter called How Dare You in My Name, in which I have a mock trial in which Jesus testifies against popes and monarchs and others who initiated all kinds of murderous acts in his name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Jesus' name. And by the way, and this is why people, Jews particularly, reject Jesus. They say, oh, look, you know, he killed millions of people. I said, well, show me one thing that he ever said or did, that people have hijacked his name. So in any event, I have this trial in which he asks all of these people, you know, well, where in my life and teachings do you get the justification for committing your acts, you know, as these people got up on their horses to mount the Crusades, what were they thinking? Did they, you know? And it says there, right there, when the Pope sent off the troops to the Crusades, he said, "This is for Jesus and for Christendom." Well,
of course, people.
What would Jesus have said to that?
Up.
Would he have said, "Hey, go for it, guys"?
Well, the same thing you could say about any fundamentalists. They always are using what they want as an excuse to make war. I mean, you could say that about the Republicans. About, you know.
Well, and people just follow them. I mean, how is it Martin Luther? And there's many quotes where he told his followers to burn down synagogues. Now here you read the Gospels, and the synagogue was Jesus' spiritual home. So I have Jesus talking to
Martin
Luther,
who was the first to break away from Roman.
Well, he
Catholic.
Broke away from Catholicism by establishing, you know, Protestantism. At first, he thought that he tried to get the Jews to go. He thought that the Jews would join him. As in a universal, you know, Protestantism protest when he broke away from Catholicism. And so he warmed up to the Jews initially, but then when the Jews refused to join him, he turned on them, and he has many edicts directed at his followers to do horrible things to, and says horrible things about Judaism. And in my mock trial, Jesus says to him, well, you know, what is that about? You know, do you know that the synagogue was my spiritual home, that I was there every Sabbath, and you're telling people to burn down synagogues?
What did Martin Luther say about that?
Well, I don't have answers from them. You can imagine your own answers, but one wonders, you know, they probably couldn't answer that. But,
well,
of course, they could say all these things because Jesus isn't here right now. So they say whatever they want in his name and do.
But, you know, the Pope would use the name of Jesus really for political purposes. And that's the same reason.
Well, that's true. That's
I think
very true.
The tribe that converted to Judaism is ignored by the Zionists because they want an allegiance to Israel, which is the homeland, and maybe it's really the steppes of Russia that's a homeland. So I'm just saying that politics has always used religion
it's
as
always
an excuse
been there, but
to get things done.
For Christians now, it's turning around, certainly with the leadership of Pope Francis. He recently said, inside every Christian is a Jew.
Francis said that?
Yes, he said that recently. Yeah.
So
now that's a really bold departure from the history of Christian-Jewish relations.
How did you feel about that? That when he said that, he said maybe he's read your
book.
Well,
I think it's genuine on his part. One of his closest friends is a rabbi from Argentina. In fact, they wrote a book together. When he was in Argentina before he became pope, so he has very warm feelings toward. Toward Judaism, and that's quite a dramatic statement to say inside every Christian is a Jew.
What did the rest of the Christian world think about that statement?
Well, I haven't heard anybody object to it. I mean, it's fairly recent, within this last year. Just Google it, you'll see it was a headline in newspapers around the world.
One more part I just want to ask you about in your book is the chapter, The Miracle of Jewish Recovery After the Holocaust, the DP Camp Story. What is that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's about an exhibit that a friend of mine mounted a couple of years ago. The Deep PCAM story is quite remarkable, and I put it in there to show that, you know, that Jews have always historically looked forward rather than backward. So
what's the story, then? Yeah.
Well, the story is that after World War II, at the end of the war, there were Deep PCAM set up by the military.
What's DP stand for?
Displaced persons.
Oh,
okay. And it
okay.
was a five-year phenomenon. And these camps were for the people who got out of concentration camps because, you know, there were so many millions of people dislocated all over Europe from where they came from. So they were in these DP camps for a period until they found a place to go to. And it was quite remarkable, almost from day... and the DP camp phenomenon, which lasted about 5 years from 1945 to 51, I think about mm-hmm. 6 years. And from day one, they started education programs, they started music programs, they had orchestras in these DP camps, they had newspapers. It's a remarkable phenomenon, and it's all represented in this exhibit that my friend mounted that traveled a bit. I told the story in the book and in the article about it when they took the exhibit to Ulm, Germany, and the woman who mounted this exhibit, Lillian Gewurzman, actually was in that DP camp in Ulm, Germany. And here she was coming back with her exhibit on the DP camps and was being received by the mayor and all the officials there for this grand opening of the exhibit. And the mayor delivered some really passionate, tear-jerking speech. But the exhibit itself is quite remarkable. That shows the resiliency of Jews and the fact that they always looked forward rather than backward, and that's why I use that as an encouragement toward the reconciliation of Judaism and Christianity, because so many Jews say, oh, you know, Jesus and his name, and it led to so much destruction and persecution of Jews. I said, well, but, you know, his name was hijacked, and you got to get over it. It's time to drop the Jesus phobia. Mm. It's time for Judaism.
You also have a chapter about the Jewish. Is the King and Queen of England Jewish?
Oh, well, that's just a little playful article. When William and Kate got together, the genealogist started looking into that. And there's some interesting things that I couldn't even recall them now that I investigated. And there are dots that connect, and there's a possibility that they're both have strong Jewish lineage.
Well, I guess a lot of people do.
Well, you know, it's just part of that 6 degrees of separation, and in some cases it's fewer than that.
Well, I do think it's time to, like, resolve the Jesus story. I mean, it's an old story. I mean, there's other stories to tell. I mean, the Western civilization has one story. You go to the East, they have lots of different myths and legends, and I always thought that was, you know, a little strange that they are so obsessed with Jesus. Yeah, let's just get over it and create a whole new civilization based on the teachings, not the teacher, you know?
That's, well, exactly. I mean, that would raise all of it to this higher level of consciousness, which is embedded in all of the great spiritual and religious traditions, but that most people just simply don't see, and they get caught in the trappings, the superficial trappings that look different.
Right. Well, good luck with your book. Any final words you would like to say about it?
Yeah, I think we covered a lot of ground.
No, thank you, Bernie. I think it's actually a very interesting book, and I think it will help if people take it seriously and look at it, the anti-Semitism, which is sort of a joke because of to be anti-Semitic is to be anti-Jesus, and if they're Christians, then, you know, how could you be anti-Jesus? Jesus, but that's, you know, what you're worshiping. Mm. So,
well, if people are interested in the exhibit, there's a website where I have information about it and some of these paintings, and that's jjartexhibit.com. jjartexhibit.com.
Okay, and the book is Jesus,
Jews, and Antisemitism in Art.
How Renaissance Art Erased Jesus' Jewish Identity and How Today's Artists Are Restoring It by Bernard Starr, S-T-A-R, the author of Jesus Uncensored, Restoring the Authentic Jesus. Thank you, Bernie.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
Okay, me too. I actually, there's a lot of stuff I didn't really know. I think you've done some great research. So good luck with this book.
Thanks.
Okay, that concludes tonight's show, which is with two former members of the Association for Spirituality Psychotherapy, who have both gone in different directions but maintain their spiritual connection, even though they're psychotherapist. So if you want any more information about that, you can go to the ASP website, asphealing.org. You can reach me at newrealities.com. I'm Alan Steinfeld. You can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. And thanks for listening, and good night.